So I wanted to start the talk tonight with a passage that I love from a wonderful classic Dharma book, Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, by Suzuki Roshi, who founded San Francisco Zen Center and Tassajara Zen Center and Green Gulch in California. It's a really wonderful book if you're looking for an inspiration. Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind. This is what he says. In our scriptures, it is said that there are four kinds of horses: excellent ones, good ones, poor ones, and bad ones. The best horse will run slow and fast, right and left, at the driver's will, before it sees the shadow of the whip. The second best will run as fast as the first one does, just before the whip reaches its skin. The third one will run when it feels pain on its body. The fourth will run after the pain penetrates to the marrow of its bones. You can imagine how difficult it is for the fourth one to learn how to run. When we hear this story, almost all of us want to be the best horse. If it's impossible to be the best one, we want to be the second best. That is, I think, the usual understanding of this story and of meditation practice. You may think that when you sit in meditation, you'll find out whether you're one of the best horses or one of the worst ones. Here, however, there is a misunderstanding of practice. If you think the aim of practice is to train you to become one of the best horses, you'll have a big problem. This is not the right understanding. If you practice meditation in the right way, it does not matter whether you are the best horse or the worst one. When you consider the compassion of the Buddha, how do you think the Buddha would feel about the four kinds of horses? He would probably have more compassion for the worst one than for the best one. When you are determined to practice with the great mind of a Buddha, you will find the worst horse is often the most valuable one. In your very imperfections, you will find the basis for your firm, way-seeking mind. Those who can sit perfectly physically usually take more time to obtain the true way of practice, the actual feeling of practice, the marrow of practice. But those who find great difficulties in practicing will find more meaning in it. So I think that sometimes the best horse may be the worst horse, and the worst horse can be the best one. Isn't that comforting for maybe some of you? Unless you sit in full lotus easily. Last night I talked about the difficulties, the hindrances, those difficult mind states and energies that visit everyone. Tonight I want to talk specifically about the judging mind, the comparing mind, the mind that says, everybody here is sitting just like a Buddha and I'm freaking out inside. Or, I have no idea what I'm doing. Or, am I doing it right? How many people had one of those thoughts, am I doing it right or good enough? Okay, see, you're not alone. This capacity, this tendency to compare and judge ourselves is very, very deep. The Buddha talked of it as the conceit of I am. And when he says the conceit of I am, he's not only talking in the usual sense of being better than, but any kind of comparing me against somebody else. What's that? What is it?
Yes, the word conceit.
Oh, the word conceit. Oh, thank you. Okay, that's it. I was wondering, the candle going down or conceit? Okay, conceit is aren't I wonderful? Feeling the opposite of modest, bragging. What's the word in?
What's called pöyhkeily?
Say it loud.
Pöyhkeily.
Is that it? Okay.
Yeah. Same as arrogance or?
Arrogance, yeah. Arrogance, similar. Okay, thank you. And I keep raising your hand if I say a word. No. The conceit of I am, which we usually think of as, look at me, but in this instance, it's not just, aren't I wonderful? It's any kind of comparing. And you might find it comforting to know that it's in this mind for a long time. In the classical development of awakening in the Theravadan tradition, Theravadan is the tradition that the earliest teachings of the Buddha have come down to, the teachings that are preserved in the Pali canon. The Pali is the language that the Buddhist teachings have been preserved in. There are four stages of enlightenment, it is said. First stage, second stage, third stage, fourth stage is fully enlightened being. And at each subsequent stage, there are you let go of certain defilements and confusions of mind. There are 10 of them. I won't go into all 10. But just to know, at the third stage of enlightenment, which is, it's pretty up there, there's still the conceit of I am. It's one of the last things to go. So if you find yourself judging or comparing, one way you can think of it is you're no higher than third stage of enlightenment. But no, you have a lot of company. This is what the Buddha also said about this. He said, one who thinks oneself equal to others or superior or inferior, for that very reason, disputes, gets into arguments. But one who is unmoved under those three conditions, for that person, the notions equal, superior, or inferior cannot exist. For one who is free from the use here, there are no ties. For one who is free from the views, there are no ties. For one who is delivered by understandings, there are no follies. But those who grasp after views and philosophical opinions, they wander about in the world annoying people. And you can probably guess who we annoy most of all with our own views of judging and comparing. Have you seen when this arises for you in these days, either here on the retreat or at home, but even let's just take the retreat. When has it come up for you? When you see people walking, that's a very social situation. You see somebody going really slowly, and you can say, wow, they're really doing it. Or you could say, who are they trying to prove? Or you can see somebody walking fast and you can say, gosh, they're not trying to impress anybody, they're just themselves. How wonderful. Or an hour later you could say, don't they get it? Why don't they just slow down? The mind will go anywhere. Or in the dining hall, that's an area rife with comparing. They're going back for a third portion. Gee, are they going to eat any food? You know, why don't they eat a little? They're a little skinny. What's that? Or I drop my fork and everybody knows I'm a klutz. Another word, klutz, awkward, you know. When does it come up for you? Just think, I won't ask you to tell me. But just make this relevant for you. When has it come up for you? Maybe sitting in the hall, imagining what everybody else is, how everybody else is meditating, and you see how sleepy or how busy or how emotional your mind is, or whatever. It's so, so common. And it's not like all of a sudden you activate the judging mind when you come here on a retreat. You're just seeing the mind that's out there in your daily life. When does it happen for you in your daily life? What particular sensitive spot is it for you? Is it your physical appearance? Is it your intellect or your creativity or your accomplishments or your lack of accomplishments? Coming from the States, it's particularly heightened in our culture because we often have this psyche of being number one. This is a tremendous burden. And Jane and I have talked about being here in Finland particularly. It's so refreshing, and I know that Finland has a history, whether it's one country or another invading, and there's not that same kind of tendency towards arrogance, but there's a real humility that's so refreshing and inspiring. In America, you say, yes, we're number one, my baseball team, my basketball team. My basketball team is pretty good. My state, my city, my whatever. In Australia and New Zealand, they have this phenomenon called the tall poppy syndrome. The tall poppy, the one who sticks out in the field, is the one that gets cut off. We can even be proud of how messed up we are, too. In college, in the 60s, I went to college, and I read a lot of existential philosophy, you know, Sartre and Camus and all of that, and it seemed like the deeper people were more messed up. And so I kind of wore my neuroses like a badge. I must be really deep, because I'm really messed up. More messed up than you. So there. We just have a tendency to connect and want to somehow make sure that we're good enough. And this is really painful. It happens whether you're a new student or you've been practicing for a long time. When I first started teaching many years ago in the early 80s, and I was you know, being in this seat was kind of intimidating and big. And I'd be on these retreats where I would I'd teach with some of the great teachers in this tradition who are very famous. If you're familiar with the books in Buddhist meditation, and we'd have these big retreats down in Southern California, where I mentioned the story about Adam last night. And one night, Joseph Goldstein, who was my main teacher, who's just quite brilliant and quite deep and clear, he'd give a talk that would just blow everybody's mind, how deep into emptiness and the clarity that came through. The next night, Jack Kornfield, another master speaker, would give a talk, and he would weave this magic spell and just hypnotize everybody. And then another night, Sharon Salzberg, who wrote the classic book on loving kindness, would give a talk, and people would be weeping as their hearts were so touched. And then I'd have to give the next talk. And I knew if I was sitting in the audience, I'd be saying, get that guy off and get Goldstein back on. It was really painful. And I went to, at one point, I went to one of my teachers, as I mentioned, Ram Dass, who has been a mentor for me. And I explained to him the situation, you know, this is so painful. And I could barely speak at times. And he gave me some great advice. He said, why don't you just be, in those days, I went by Jamie. I've been James for the last 30 years. I grew up kind of. He said, why don't you just be, he said, Joseph Goldstein is already taken. Don't try to be Joseph Goldstein. Why don't you just be the best Jamie Barras you can be? You might find he has something to say, and you might even like what comes out of his mouth. It was really so helpful, so important. It took me a while to find my voice, but if you're trying to be somebody else, you can't be as good a them as they are. Why not find out who you are? This is a piece from a very, also very wise monk. Oh, maybe did I mention Ajahn Sumedho in here?
Yeah.
No. Ajahn Sumedho, a Western monk, an American monk, the senior Western monk in the Theravadan tradition, and he started he was a student of Ajahn Chah, who was Jack Kornfield's teacher, and he was like Jack's big brother when he first went to Thailand to study with Ajahn Chah, and then developed all of these various monasteries around the world. He's now in his 80s. And he talks about his own judging mind around giving Dharma talks. He says, when I was young, I was very self-conscious. To say something in public was absolutely terrifying for me. Even when I was in the Navy, just having to raise my voice to say, aye, aye, sir, in public, in a roll call, would have me shaking because of self-consciousness. Then I became a school teacher. Teaching 8 and 9 year old Chinese kids in northern Borneo for a couple of years, that wasn't such a threat. But then, becoming a monk in Thailand, and eventually having to give talks to Thai people in Thai, all of this self-consciousness became apparent. The highs you'd get when you felt you'd given a good talk, and everybody says, you're really good, Sumedho. You can give good Dharma. Then sometimes I'd give a really stupid talk and think, I don't want to give another talk ever again. I didn't become a monk to give talks. But the idea was to keep watching this. Ajahn Chah would always encourage me to keep aware of the pride, the conceit, the embarrassment, the self-consciousness that I'd feel. And fortunately, in Thailand, people are such that they're just grateful for a monk giving a talk. Even if it's not a very good talk, it doesn't seem to upset them very much. They seem quite grateful about it. So that made it a bit easier. One time, at a ceremony where we had to sit up all night, Ajahn Chah said, "Sumedho, you have to give a talk for 3 hours tonight." And up till then, I'd only talked for half an hour. That was a strain. But 3 hours, and he knew. Now, with Ajahn Chah, I always felt that if he said something, I'd do it. So I sat up on the high seat and talked for 3 hours. And I had to sit there and watch people get up and leave. And I had to sit there and watch people just lie down on the floor and sleep in front of me. And at the end of the 3 hours, there were still a few polite old ladies sitting up there. Now, Ajahn Chah wasn't saying, "Okay, Sumedho, go in there and really bowl them over with some scintillating stuff, some exciting stuff. Entertain them, really sock it to them." I began to realize that what he wanted me to do was to be able to look at the self-consciousness, the posing, the pride, the conceit, the grumbling, the lazy, the not wanting to be bothered, the wanting to please, the wanting to entertain, the wanting to get approval. All these have come up during these talks of all these years, but the meditation is one in which more and more one feels a real understanding of the suffering of all of this self-view. And then through that insight, one realizes the abiding in emptiness. So this judging mind, this comparing mind that's there until you're fully enlightened, where does it come from? When I look, I see it's rooted in fear, in somehow thinking, I'm not good enough, or I'm not complete, or if I'm found out, then I'll be seen as a fraud. Whether it's self-judgment, or self-loathing, or self-critic, or self-hatred, it's all about self. And self, this self, not being good enough. Even the ones who are having their chest puffed out and say, "Look at me." Generally, it's rooted in fear of trying to prove that I am good enough. Mm. And this is so painful, and it's a misunderstanding of the truth. Because when we take a look, we see we are just this expression of life that has never manifested before as you. And when we see it, and we see how humbling it is, we see that we're not alone in this. I was at a retreat many years ago. I was at a three-month retreat. Every year in Massachusetts, there's a retreat that we do what we're doing here over a three-month period, you might believe it or not. You know? And you might think, oh, 3 months of this? Oh my goodness, no. But actually, it gets really interesting. You're going through the hardest part of a long retreat. And after a while, it gets quite fascinating and interesting. Anyway, I'd done that a few times. And on my second three-month retreat, this is in 1979, the Dalai Lama came at the end of the retreat to visit the retreatants there. He had just come to the United States for the very first time a few months before, and he wanted to meet with the serious practitioners. So he had a question and answer period at the end of the near the end of the retreat. He came and visited. It's a great way to end the retreat, by the way, having the Dalai Lama come and do a little Q&A with you. And somebody on the retreat, among the questions, somebody raised his hand and said, do you have any advice how to work with self-hatred? And the Dalai Lama's translator explained to him, and at first His Holiness didn't get the concept, self-hatred, and they went back and forth until finally the Dalai Lama understood this alien concept, and he looked at this guy and he said, you're wrong, you're absolutely wrong. Can you imagine sitting for 2.5 months and the Dalai Lama saying, you are wrong? But he said it with such compassion, and he went on to say something like what I got. What makes you think that everything else is part of the universe, part of the fabric of life, and that you're a mistake and you're not good enough? This is great misunderstanding. It was really beautiful the way he responded. There's a teaching in this body of wisdom from the Christian teachings called the Course in Miracles. I don't know if Course in Miracles has ever made it here in Finland. And yes, and there's one line I love that it says, believing in your littleness, your smallness, is arrogant because it's preferring your own opinion to God's. Believing in your littleness is arrogant because it's preferring your own opinion to God's. What makes you think you know better than God or the Dharma or life that's just manifested just as you, the perfect you? But we have this very deeply ingrained, as has been said, and we can get caught so easily. So the meditation practice is really pointing to seeing through this misunderstanding of who we think we are. And one way that this comes about, this misunderstanding comes about, is seeing how what we're composed of. There are certain aspects of the mind that naturally compare. In the teachings, one teaching is on the five aggregates or five skandhas, sometimes called five khandhas, that make up who we are. We are form, this physical body, feeling, which means actually pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral, perception, where you recognize things, mental formations, that mind and different emotions that come through, and a consciousness that knows. So one is about the body and the other four is about the mind. Form, feeling, perception, mental formation, and consciousness. And the third skanda of perception, which is just recognizing experience, is where our comparing mind often comes into play. Because it is trying to, it puts in the hard drive, or recognizes in the hard drive something that it tries to sort out. What is this? Oh, this is a bell. Oh, this is a pretty bell. Or this is a smaller bell than that other bell. Or this is a bigger bell than this smaller bell here. And so, of course, we need to understand and recognize experience so we can file it and work with our exterior. But this perception, along with mental formations, naturally leads to a lot of comparing. And often when it's about us, comparing us to those other human beings around, oh, I'm smaller than that one, I'm taller than that one, I have straighter hair than that one, I have curlier hair than that one. And it can be, oh, I have straighter hair than that one. I wish I had curlier hair like that. Or, I have curly hair like that one. I wish I had straighter hair like that. And on and on and on. There's no end to the comparing mind. And when we just see everybody as they are, without better or worse, then there's a sense of appreciation for all the different ways that life expresses. If you go out into a forest, for instance, you can see all the trees for what they are. If you see an old gnarled tree, gnarled is kind of like has knots and all like that, you probably don't say, gee, too bad that tree isn't a little straighter. That tree has character. Or if it's a straight one, oh, gee, it should just have a few more fluffy leaves. Then it would be okay. Every tree is just fine the way it is, isn't it? Or you go into a field of daisies and, gee, that daisy isn't quite as good as the others. They're all part of the big field. But when it comes to humans, it's a different story. And somehow, as that fellow at the retreat saw, we end up not being as good as everybody else. Often, not always, or sometimes we end up being better than everybody else. But again, this is just a misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. So the idea is to see through this concept of taking ownership of my experience, my messed up mind, my sleepy body, my knee that hurts. Why does my knee have to hurt? I wonder if their knee hurts. Yeah. But this knee hurts. And stop it! Or I'm so pathetic because this knee hurts. Your body follows its own laws. And to see it in that way is tremendously freeing. And to see who you are is tremendously freeing. Mm. So, how to work with this judging mind, this comparing mind? I thought I'd share with you a few tips that I find helpful. The first one we've been talking about here from time to time, and that is having tremendous compassion for this habit of mind. It just is a habit that doesn't know any better, and we've been practicing it for a long time. You might think you're the only one that has this habit. Remember, third stage. You've got a lot of company. This is part of the human experience. And when you see that habit of judging, that beautiful self-compassion practice that Jane has shown is so helpful. Just putting your hand on your heart, even if you don't say the words, is enough. Oh, to just soothe yourself. Oh, wow, this is hard. Oh, this is part of life. Let me hold this with kindness. If every time you saw that habit and you could hold it that way, you would really be doing a powerful transformation on that judging mind. I shared in a group today my version of that practice that I did for a few years. This was many years ago, when I saw how much my mind was judging, and I realized I was just getting deeper and deeper into the quicksand of judging. And it occurred to me that the more I judged the judging mind, the deeper I was going. And I'd notice, oh, my mind is everywhere. Darn. And then I'd see, oh, that's a judgment. And then I'd say, oh, I just did it again. Stop it. There's no end to judging the judging and judging the judging of the judging all the way. So it occurred to me there might be another way. And this is what I did. This was my main practice for 2 years. I share this in one of the groups today. And you can try this. This is a variation from the self-compassion practice. Suppose you see yourself judging, giving yourself a hard time, that critic in there that has so perfected its stories. Try this. Close your eyes. Lie down. And then put your hand on your cheek. And first, feel the tenderness right through your hand. And as if you were the kindest, wisest being, a grandmother, or the Dalai Lama, or Kuan Yin, or Mother Mary, or whoever, just saying to yourself, in the kindest voice, judging, it's okay, dear, it's just judging. And let yourself feel it for a moment. Okay, you can open your eyes. That's how I recommend you notice the judging mind. That was my main practice for, like I said, for about 2 years. And it wasn't, I didn't do this every time. I did it a lot at the beginning, or when I'd start noticing that harsh voice, I'd do it just to remind myself. Because just like this, I found that touching myself with tenderness reminded. But after a while, the tone of voice started to bring the compassion right there. And so, after a while, it was, you know, oh, there you are thinking, oh, judging. And then it became kind of exciting. Then it was every time I'd notice a judging thought was a chance for me to practice compassion. So it turned it around completely. Oh, another judging thought. Oh, it's okay. It's time to be kind to myself. You might try that or this or whatever variation, but the key is when you notice it with tenderness and kindness. So that's the first one, bringing compassion and forgiveness and kindness to your heart and to your mind. Mm-hmm. Forgiveness also for the habits that you've practiced, because they run so deep. another story from my long retreat, my first long retreat, where I really got into walking meditation. When I first started doing this, in my early years of practice, much different than now, I would, and some people have found this, when you go very slowly, it can feel really psychedelic, just very interesting. So I, at times, would love to go slowly. Not because I was trying to, but just, it was fun. Sometimes, by the way, I'd be noticing, I'd be walking slowly, and I'd be all by myself, and I'd be just enjoying myself. Somebody else would come in, and I'd start noting, I used mental noting instead of lifting, moving, placing. I'd start noting, lifting, moving, looking good. Looking good. Because I was honest with what was going on here. You know. But anyway, in this one moment that was really a watershed moment for me, I was all by myself walking in the walking room in the center in Massachusetts. And I decided I'd play a game and see how slowly I could go. And I pretended that I was the great French mime Marcel Marceau, who some of you, I'm sure, remember, who would move, and you couldn't even tell he was moving, but somehow he was moving. And so I just thought I'd play this game, have fun. Okay, how does he do it? Just see how slowly I go. And in the middle of this game, somebody came into the walking room who had just come onto the retreat. In the first 2 years of the center in Massachusetts, they tacked on a 2-week retreat at the end of the 3-month retreat. Not a good idea. They only did it for a couple of years because you could really feel people's energy from the outside. So this person came in doing walking meditation, and there I was doing my game. And I thought, oh God, this is really going to be weird, but I'm not going to change my game. I'm just going to keep on going. And sure enough, after about 2 minutes, this person bolted out of the room in what I was sure was the comparing mind. And as she crossed my field of vision, the thought came to me, really blew her mind. Pretty good yogi, aren't I? And then I heard the thought in all of its glory, all of its ego, all of its disgusting presentation, and it was really painful. I then became like a caged tiger, and I was going back and forth, saying, I'll never get rid of this mind. What a phony you are. Who do you think you are, trying to impress everybody? Look at all this ego, and look at me, and all that. And I did that for about 10 minutes, just, how can I get out of this mind? And then it occurred to me, the millions and millions of times I'd had that kind of a thought, I wasn't clear enough to catch it, but in my practice, after 3 months, I saw it. And when I thought of the millions of times that I'd practiced that kind of thought, oh, look at me, am I good enough? Do you notice me? In this lifetime, and by then I was thinking in terms of many lifetimes, which just completely boggled my mind, in a moment, a very key moment in my life, I had this wave of deep compassion and forgiveness, saying, you are trying to do the best you can. You really are. This is going to take a long time. You've practiced it another way. So just be kind to yourself. And it really melted my heart. It was one of the first times that I can remember genuinely saying, oh yes, you're really okay. You're trying. It's okay. That was much more important than seeing how slowly I could go. And it has stayed with me all of these now 40 years later, 1976 that was. Just a moment of forgiveness for how deep the conditioning can be, a life-changing moment. So that's the first, forgiveness and compassion. A second way to deal with the judging mind, the comparing mind, is to see how empty it is. And this is seeing it with wisdom. And just seeing, you, like I said the first night, you don't have control over your thoughts. If you did, you'd only have beautiful, loving thoughts. So to see these thoughts come in all by themselves, and taking responsibility or blame or ownership is a really, it's just a misunderstanding. This is what the Buddha was pointing out. Take a look and see clearly how these thoughts just come in all by themselves. My teacher, Joseph, has a very good instruction. You might find this helpful. He says, if you are sitting in a meditation hall and you're bothered by your thoughts, just imagine they're coming from the person behind you. It works. You don't have to blame yourself for your thoughts. They're just coming. Who knows where you picked them up, what radio waves they came in. You are not your thoughts. As somebody said in the last retreat we did just before coming here, also in Finland, it was beautiful. In one of the groups, she said, I'm seeing now my mind is not my fault. It was a powerful transmission. Your mind is not your fault. Our friend Wes Nisker, who's one of the Spirit Rock teachers and very funny and writer, he just came out with a book a few months ago. The title of it is You Are Not Your Fault. So that's a second, just seeing the emptiness of the thoughts. Your thoughts are as real as you believe them to be and as empty as you see them to be. You can have any thought in the world and either latch on and say, oh, that's true, or see, oh, that's just a thought. That's why sometimes naming it, oh, thinking, it doesn't matter what kind of thought it is, whether it's a beautiful or an ugly thought, no, it's just thinking. And if you don't mess with it, as I said in one of the groups today, the Tibetans have this beautiful teaching. They say that if you don't struggle or battle with your thoughts, they self-liberate. They just unravel all on their own because you're not fighting or getting hooked by them. Comes and goes. How many thoughts have you had today? How many? Thousands, thousands. Where did they come from? Oh, the person behind you. Thank you. And yours came from the person behind you. Yeah. And which one of them can you say, oh, that's me? They just come out of nowhere and go into nowhere. So that's a second one. Forgiveness, compassion, wisdom, seeing how empty those thoughts are. Another aspect of or another way to work with the comparing mind is having a sense of humor, it really makes a difference. You can get very serious in this practice, as I've mentioned a few times. Yes, I'm a meditator. I'm a lousy meditator. I'm a meditator. No. No bonus points for grimness. Okay, grimness is not a factor of awakening. Having a sense of humor makes a huge difference, because then you can kind of laugh at this mind. And instead of, what I often like to say is, instead of seeing it and going, oh gosh, look at my mind, if you have a little bit of space and say, wow, look at the mind, it's amazing, you can really, you can be in on the joke, the cosmic joke of having a mind, instead of the butt of the joke. You know, oh, look at my mind. Wow, look at the mind. It's amazing. Makes a huge difference to take it light. Because in the moment that you can laugh, you're not taking it personally. You're kind of looking at it from another perspective and saying, oh, it's just the mind doing its thing. On one retreat, I was looking at the judging mind, and I love this one teaching. My favorite of all Dharma teachings is this this treatise called Verses on the Faith Mind by Sengstan, known as the Third Zen Patriarch of China. And one of the lines there is, the burdensome practice of judging brings annoyance and weariness. The burdensome burden, like having a heavy burden, the burdensome practice of judging brings annoyance and weariness. And let's see the candle going again. It's just wax. So that made a lot of sense to me, the burdensome practice of judging. So every time I would notice a judging thought, I would just say, the burdensome practice of judging. Okay. So, and particularly when you go to meals, that you'd have a lot of, I'd have a lot of opportunity. And there I'd be saying, you know, oh, who does she think she is? Miss Mindfulness. The burdensome practice of judging. Yeah. And I would go through a meal saying that 50, 75 times at least. After a while, it was a comedy. Look at this mind do its thing. It keeps on coming out. You know, a comment on everybody on and everything. Look at him, burdens and practice of judging. And it was tremendously freeing to just have a playfulness about it. Another thing that we can, that I want to do, maybe coming to a close, is doing loving kindness for ourselves, which is a bit different than compassion for ourselves. Compassion is when you see the difficult stuff, the suffering, and you're kind with it. But loving kindness, and we did some loving kindness today, is really seeing the goodness inside. And you know, so we did some yesterday, and Jane did some today, where you're really looking at your goodness. This is from a passage from Jack Kornfield's book, The Art of Forgiveness, Loving Kindness, and Peace. He says, or it says, in the Babemba tribe of Africa, when a person acts irresponsibly or unjustly, he's placed in the center of the village, alone and unfettered. All work ceases, and every man, woman, and child in the village gathers in a large circle around the accused individual. Then each person in the tribe speaks to the accused one at a time, each recalling the good things the person in the center of the circle has done in his lifetime. Every incident, every experience that can be recalled with any detail and accuracy is recounted. All his positive attributes, good deeds, strengths, and kindnesses are recited carefully and at length. This tribal ceremony often lasts for several days. At the end, the tribal circle is broken, a joyous celebration takes place, and the person is symbolically and literally welcomed back into the tribe. Pretty good tribe to hang out with. Doesn't it make sense? Were you wondering, oh, what are they going to do to this guy? And then you hear, oh, they just remind him of his goodness. That's what we need to do. So I want to close by sharing a loving kindness practice towards ourselves that might help you connect with this. And this is something that I hit upon in my own practice of loving kindness. I was doing a 6-week period of metta and heart practices, and the first week I was doing it just for myself. May I be safe, may I be happy, may I be healthy, be peaceful. And it was okay, but it wasn't really knock your socks off loving kindness. And after a few days, somebody came to my mind that I knew really loved me. I didn't know why, but I knew this person really loved me. And then I magically asked myself, why do they love me? I said, this would be so easy if I could just see myself like they did. And then I said, oh, well, what do they see anyway? And that's when I hit upon my version of this practice. So close your eyes for a moment. And bring to mind someone who you have a really sweet, loving connection with. It can be a friend, like Jane said, someone who brings a smile to your face, or a pet, or a relative, or somebody who roots for you, but just somebody who you enjoy being around. And imagine they're right here with you, and maybe smiling back at you, oh, thank you for picking me. And just feel that sweet energy between you. How lovely that we can create that with another person. And now for a few moments, see if you can imagine inhabiting their reality and looking through their eyes. See who they see when they're with their dear friend. What touches them about you? All the beautiful qualities, maybe your playfulness or your kindness or your creativity or intelligence. Drink it all in. See all the things that shine through you that touch them. And from their vantage point, first see that they would just wish for your happiness and kindness. And wish that from them, from their vantage point. Oh, may you really see all the goodness inside. May you be happy. May you have peace inside. May you see yourself the way I do. And now let your consciousness come back from their vantage point to right inside your own skin and stay connected with what you saw, that they saw, and wish that for yourself. May I really be happy. May I see all my goodness inside. May I be kind to myself. if you can, if you want, you can open your eyes. Maybe you saw just even a little glimpse of what your friend sees. And if you didn't, no judgment. But if you did even a little glimpse, then you can't pretend you're not worthy of kindness and happiness anymore. So it's just a matter of more and more getting in touch with the gifts that you've been given in your life. If you met yourself from the outside, suppose you met somebody who really understood you, right? Who really understood your humor and liked your taste and liked your take on things. Wouldn't you like meeting somebody who really got you? There's one person that gets every joke that goes through your head. Only one. And if you met yourself, you'd probably be saying, "Where have you been all my life? What a cool person." But from the inside, it feels a little bit differently. So this is about seeing yourself as others see you. And you might incorporate this as part of your practice to work with the judging and the comparing mind. Because when you see it, there's no comparison. You can't compare yourself against anyone else. There's only one of you. Can you say, "My unconditional love is better than your unconditional love"? It doesn't make any sense. "My awareness is better than yours"? No. To just see yourself for who you are, and the more you see who you are, the more everything that you've been given shines through, and everybody gets it. So be very patient with this, and very kind, and know that every time you see that judging mind with kindness, you are transforming your relationship and getting to know who you really are. So, take a moment to just let the words settle.